need to preach tonight because worship kind of felt like we already like went to church, y'all. Like, so good. But yeah, I'm Sarah Bryce, as Sib said, for those of you who don't know me, and that might be quite a bit of you because I feel like we're all still getting to know each other here. But I'm Sarah Bryce. I'm married to Joel Bryce there. We have two daughters. Victoria, the oldest, is in kids' church. Abrielle's right there. Can you say hi, Abrielle? No. She's our shy one. But while we're on this note, Joel, Abrielle, I need to set the record straight before we go any further. For those of you who were here last week, Joel said something to the effect of, correct me if I'm wrong, that Abrielle liked him more than me. I was like, what the heck? Okay, here's the thing. Joel's an amazing dad. The girls adore him. They're both a little bit of daddy's girls. But I birthed them. I birthed them. Not only do they like me, they love me, and they have no choice for the rest of their lives. So anyways, I just thought I had the microphone now. So I was going to set the record straight. Okay? So now we can move on. But yeah, we're continuing on in our series tonight. Guys, I'm going to do my best to do this thing, but I might get dizzy like Marcia. But yeah, we're continuing on our series in Mark. We're going to pick up in chapter 5, where Siv left off last week. But before we go there, by way of further introducing myself to you all and letting you in to me and my world and my story, but also setting the stage for where we're going in Mark, I just want to tell you a little story about myself. Is that okay? Yeah. And are you okay if I'm real and vulnerable? Because I'm about to be. Okay, so I grew up, well, okay, some of you saw my parents, probably most of you. They were here visiting, right? We sit in a circle, you probably saw them. They're home now, they're back in the States, in Iowa, where I grew up. But I have lovely parents. I grew up in a Christian home, I had two sisters. I heard about Jesus my whole life, right? Like, we were at church every Sunday, I was youth group every Thursday. We were like that good old little Midwestern Christian family. You know, Ashley, you know. She's American. Guys, I was even like a cheerleader in high school. This is like kind of the all-American, like, it's almost annoying. This is kind of my growing up story, right? Unless you think I'm, you know, I was this perfect girl. Talk to my parents. I was an angsty teenager. I was a bit difficult. Had my fair share of regrettable teenager decisions. But in high school, I started this job. I was working at this little iconic restaurant in my hometown, and it was kind of like the spot to work. Like, for high school kids, it was like, you've landed a sweet job if you're at this place. It's fun. Tourists coming through, which, not that our town had many tourists, but anyways, it was fun. And about a year or so into working there, I was sexually abused by the manager who owned said restaurant. And you guys, this rocked me. It broke me. I pushed away from my faith. I pushed away from my family. I couldn't reconcile how this broken girl now, like, how she fit here anymore, right? And so in attempts to kind of numb myself and hide from it, I made further bad teenager choices. And yeah, the next 2.5 years were just a really broken couple years for me. I was numb, I was hardened, I was broken. And then I will never forget this one night. It was actually the night of my older sister's wedding, and I was laying in bed that night, and you guys, you know that feeling when, like, the butterflies in your stomach are all but coming out of your mouth, and, like, maybe you actually might throw up in that moment? That's how I felt. I was literally, like, responding viscerally to this internal knowing that I have a choice in this moment. I have a choice right now to stay in this place of brokenness or to boldly go after this guy Jesus that I've actually heard about my whole life and dare to believe that maybe he's the healing I need, right? And you guys, I was like, and by morning, wrestling through all that, I had decided that I was quitting the different job I was at the time, but it was a great job for a 20-year-old girl paying her way through university, which I was. I put in my notice for that job. I was done. I was quitting. I paused my university studies. I broke up with the guy I was dating who was planning to marry me. And I packed up Joel's Joel's grateful. I'm not sure that marrying anyone at 20 is a good idea, but I don't know, maybe. I was 24 when I married Joel. But anyways, I packed up the few bit of possessions that I had. And yeah, 2 weeks from that night, I was in a car driving to Kansas City in desperate pursuit of Jesus. And I wasn't quite sure what I'd find. I wasn't quite sure fully what he would offer, but I knew I had to go. So I'm gonna take a drink. I share that. Thank you. I share that because, one, this is me. This is who I am. This is my story. This is my journey with Jesus. But like I said, it really, as I was thinking about an intro story to share, I was like, yep, this kind of perfectly sets the scene for where we're going here in Mark. So in the passage we're about to read, we're going to be introduced to two characters, two people. They're real people. They're not characters. One is a man named Jairus, and he's a synagogue leader in the community. The other is an unnamed woman. But both of them approach Jesus in this story from really desperate places. So let's pick up where we did. Jesus and the woman, they're going to be our main protagonists tonight. We're going to really focus in on them, but there's some important stuff I want to highlight with Jairus as well. So let's pick up in Mark 5, verse 21, where we left off. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue named Jairus came, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet, and he begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter's at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who'd been suffering from hemorrhages or bleeding for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus, and she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." And immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. And immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see this crowd pressing in on you. How can you say who touched me?" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." So here's the scene, right? Like, Jesus crosses over the sea. He's getting out of the boat. The rumors about him are spreading. This guy's healing people. He's casting out demons. He's saying some weird stuff. But people are hearing about this man, Jesus, and the crowds are flocking. And then we're introduced to Jairus, the synagogue leader, right? He's desperate. He falls at the feet of Jesus. And guys, remember, they wouldn't have fully known who, they don't know yet who he is. They're still like, who is this dude? We know in hindsight, right? Jesus, Messiah, Son of God. Like, they're still very unclear who this man is. He's just doing some incredible and arguably weird stuff. So they're flocking, and then we're introduced to Jairus. He's desperate. He falls at Jesus' feet. "My daughter's on her deathbed," and they begin en route, right? So I picture them walking, the crowd getting bigger and bigger and bigger as they walk because the rumors keep spreading that Jesus guy is here. And then as they're walking, we're introduced to this woman, right? And I want to talk about her. I really like this woman. But before we do, I want to take us back a little bit and go to Leviticus. This is not a book I spend a lot of time in the Bible. For those of you who are not super familiar with this book, as in Leviticus and or the Bible itself, Leviticus is ultimately a book of laws that was given to Moses by God to the Israelites as they were coming out of slavery from Egypt, right? So it's a book of laws. But these are the laws, the Mosaic Levitical laws, that the people, first century Jews, in this story that we're reading about, these are the laws they would have been adhering to and living under. So before we talk about this woman, I want to read from Leviticus, chapter 15, verse 25. "If a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her menstrual impurity, or if she has a discharge beyond the time of her menstrual impurity, all the days of the discharge she shall continue uncleanness. As in the days of her menstrual impurity, she shall be unclean." Hi. "Every bed on which she lies during all the days of her discharge, she shall be treated as the days of her... every bed on which she lies during all the days of her discharge shall be treated as the bed of her impurity, and everything on which she sits shall be unclean, as in the uncleanness of her impurity. Whoever touches these things shall be unclean, and shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until the evening. If she's cleansed of her discharge, she'll count 7 days, and after that she'll be clean. On the eighth day, she'll take 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons and bring them to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and the priest shall make atonement on her behalf before the Lord for her unclean discharge. Thus, you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness so they do not die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst. Whoa, y'all. Welcome to Every Nation Bryanston. Last week, we're talking about casting out demons, and tonight we're talking about menstrual impurity. Okay? So welcome. We just keep it real. But I think, and I was trying to lighten that up a little bit, right? It's intense. But I think it's important to remember the context in which these people are in. This woman, like, this is the weight of what this woman's living under. Okay, so this woman, here's what we know. She has been bleeding. She has been unclean for 12 years. It says that she has spent all that she had trying to seek out healing. She's gone to doctors. It says she actually suffered much under their care. So arguably, even seeing these doctors was causing more suffering. Maybe it was emotional. I don't know. But she suffered much under their care. And she only grew worse. So whatever it was they were doing, nothing got better. We don't know a ton more about her. We're not getting a lot of information, but based on what we know of the time and the culture, we can probably assume that she was married and maybe had children, given arguably around 12-ish years of age they're getting married. So assuming she does, and again, we don't know, but regardless, she would not have been able to touch her husband or children, friends, family, community. She would not have been allowed in the synagogue. She would have been defiling it. Again, at the time and context that we're talking about, the role of the woman was most assuredly in the home. She would not have been able to touch things in her home. If she touched them, she defiled them. If she cooked food for them, they were dirty. If she touched their clothes, they were dirty. This woman was literally all but cut off, right, from anyone and everyone. Think how lonely this woman was, right? Like, the emotional toll that these 12 years would have taken on her. Like, so intense. So intense. And then not only emotionally, but thinking from a physical perspective, if you are bleeding for 12 years, you are very anemic. You are insanely weak, insanely tired. This woman literally probably didn't have the energy to even get out of bed in the morning. This is a desperate, broken, lonely, hurting woman, right? And so this is the woman who we now comes on the scene as they're in route, right? Jesus, Jairus, the crowd, they're walking, and then all of a sudden we're introduced to this woman. And you guys, she too would have been hearing these rumors about Jesus, right? He's healing people, he's casting out demons, all this stuff. And I picture this woman in this broken, desperate, lonely, unclean state, all that she would have thought about herself, and all of a sudden she's like, these rumors of Jesus, something is sparked inside of her, and she's got this, like, new, she's like willing to believe for a second that, like, maybe this guy, maybe he could heal me. Like, it sparks this, like, bold, audacious, it would have been defiant desire to go after this man, right? Like, she was defying the laws of her culture to do this, right? So I picture her, like, she's like, it's this thing sparked in her. She's like, okay, and she's mustering up every bit of energy she has because she's so weak, she's so tired, she's convincing herself she can do this. But I feel like, again, we don't know, but I imagine a relatively small community here. This woman was probably known, right? She's the unclean woman. Remember when Siv was saying with the leper, like, he'd have to announce, unclean, unclean, when he came into a place? Like, similarly, this woman, she would have been known as the unclean woman. So I picture her on that day, like, I gotta hide myself, I gotta try to disguise myself. So I picture this, like she's like kind of stealthily, her face is covered, hidden, she's somehow trying to disguise who she is, and then she's like trying to like hide amongst the chaos of the crowd. Just to like, if I could just get to Jesus, if I could just touch him, maybe I could be healed. So she's working her way through the crowd, she finally gets there, and she's like, ooh. And like, gets it right. And it says, in the instant she touches him, she knows she's been healed. She feels the healing in her body. I picture her frozen in that moment, you guys, like literally stunned, stunned. The crowd's still like booming past, right? Like they haven't realized yet what's happened. This woman's like, holy crap, holy crap. But it says in the same instant, she probably didn't say that, but in the same instant, it says in the same moment, Jesus knows power's gone out from him, right? So I picture Jesus like, boom. It says he stops and he says, who touched me? So I picture them, right? They know in this moment, like, something has just happened. The rest of the crowd's still like, we're going to pray for this little girl. And they're like, Jesus and this woman know something's just taken place. And he stops and says to the disciples, who touched me? And they all but mock him, right? Like, this is a huge crowd of people. It says people are pressed in on every side. He's probably getting touched by a lot of people, right? But he knew this touch as something different. He felt the power go out from him. So the disciples all but mock him, like, dude, like, there's no way to know who touched you. What are you talking about? But he's insistent, right? He's insistent. And he scans the crowd. I can't take a drink right now. He scans the crowd, and he says, no, who touched me? And it says that she comes forward in fear and trembling and falls at his feet. You guys, think of what this woman's fearing right now. She's like, I'm about to be shamed and ridiculed and punished, right? She is like so scared. So it says she comes and she falls at his feet, fear and trembling, and she tells her whole truth. You guys, I feel like I've read this story a million times and I've skipped past this part. But I feel like we need to understand the weight of what her whole truth would have been, right? So bear with me for a minute. She falls at his feet. She's like, teacher, forgive me. Forgive me. I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know where else to go for 12 years. For 12 years, I've been sick and I've been suffering and I didn't know where to go. And I thought that maybe you could heal me. And I know I've defiled you. I know I've defiled you. I'm so sorry. I shouldn't have touched you. And I know I must have sinned in some way to have been punished with this disease, but I don't even know what I've done. Please forgive me. Please forgive me. You guys, this would have been this woman's whole truth. Broken, desperate, ashamed, right? And I picture the crowd, you guys, right? They're like, oh, snap, it was her. Like, they know her. They know this unclean woman, and she just touched him. Like, they're waiting for, like, oh, what's he gonna do? He's gonna lay the smack down. This girl's about to get, like, riddled, right? And instead, Jesus looks at her and says, daughter, you guys, maybe other than a husband and wife relationship, I'm not sure you can have a deeper love, like a word that embodies such devotion, such love, such tenderness. He says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Be healed. Go in peace. Be healed of your disease. Like, crazy. And the thing that strikes me, I mean, daughter, it's like insane that he said that her, but then more so he says that her faith healed her, right? And I'm like, Marsha kind of talked about this when she preached a few weeks ago. Like, they didn't fully know who Jesus was, so it's not like her faith was like, Jesus, I believe in you, I know you can heal me. Like, that was not her faith. Her faith was this bold, defiant, insistent, audacious, pushing past all that she'd been told about herself, all that she believed about herself, all of her weakness, all of her brokenness, to dare to believe that if I touch this man, I might be healed, right? That was her faith. That was her faith. Like, she just had to get to Jesus, right? And now I want to talk about Jesus. Can we do that? Because it's church, so I think we can. Oh, you guys, I feel like I've like re-fallen in love with Jesus prepping for this. You guys, Jesus didn't have to stop to talk to that woman, right? He was en route with this prominent male in the community to heal this little girl who's about to die. You guys, the fact that he turned his attention from this prominent male, right? He's en route with prominent male to save said daughter, and turns his attention to this dirty, unclean woman. This is like, you guys, we're in a culture and time. This is patriarchy at its finest. This was insane that Jesus did this. Insane. But he did. And he didn't have to stop, right? It says that she was healed in the moment she touched him. She was already healed, right? Physically, she was already healed. He would have been completely justified culturally, but like from a healing perspective, right? Like he would have been completely justified to carry on. But he was insistent that he stop and find out who touched him. And you guys, here's the point. Here's the reason. And I'm quoting one of my favorite theologians right now, N.T. Wright. Jesus did not come to simply be a one-man emergency medical center. Right? His aim went so much deeper. You guys, the word that we read in the New Testament, salvation, comes from the Greek word soteria. That Greek word soteria also means healing. When Jesus was saving, he was healing. When he was healing, he was saving. They were not separate from one another. And in the English word salvation comes from the Latin word salve, like an ointment we put on a burn or a wound. You guys, Jesus was about healing people and saving them at a soul deep level. She was healed physically by his touch, right? She was healed by his touch, but she was saved by his word, right? She was saved because he stopped and he spoke with her. And this is what Jesus was about. And I feel like I also need to like help us see the weight of what Jesus's response was to her, right? So she's down, she tells her whole truth, and we know his response to her, right? Daughter, your faith has healed you. Be healed, go in peace. But I just feel like this is the reality of what that moment would have been. This would have been the weight of what Jesus says to her, right? I feel like he would have bent down, touched her, right? Again, to everyone else, this unclean woman, he's touching her, lifting her up. Her head is down, she can't even look at him. He's lifting her up, he's saying, daughter, he's lifting her face because she can't even look at him, right? She's too like, daughter, never could you defile me. Never could you defile me. And I know that your blood has enslaved you, but my blood will set you free. You are no longer an outsider. You are clean. You are whole. You are saved. You are free. Go in peace. You guys, this is the weight of what Jesus was saying to her in that moment. He made clear in that moment to her and her whole community that her healing was done, that this was healing to a soul deep level. There was no 7-day waiting period. There was no 2 pigeons, 2 turtle doves that need to be done. He made clear in that moment that the work was done, right? But he was also, you guys, making insanely clear that a new way and a new kingdom was at hand. He was turning on its head the societal and religious norms of the time. And he was making clear in that moment to her and everyone gathered there that all, even dirty, unclean women, all have access to the grace and love of Jesus. You guys, and I mean, we've talked about how dirty and unclean she was, but I feel like we also have to recognize, and I touched on it earlier, simply because she was a woman, Jesus shouldn't have been speaking with her. Like, again, this is a time in a culture where you wouldn't even address a woman, let alone a dirty woman, an unclean woman in public. Like, you just wouldn't do it. So, if we can define feminism to simply be believing that a man and a woman are of equal worth and value, guys, I want to be so bold as to say that Jesus was a forerunner in the feminist movement, right? I'm just saying it. No, we've hyped this word up. We've hyped this word up. But the truth is, Jesus was making clear that this woman is of equal value to every single one of you men in this place. And he did it time and time again, okay? So I know, it's risky. But I'm just saying, if that's what we understand it to be, that a woman and a man, equal. Jesus, in that moment, was turning on its head their thinking about male, female, who's welcome, who's in, who's not, right? And I want to quote a favorite Christian thinker and author of mine, Sarah Bessie, because I feel like she says it so well. She says, "And then came Jesus. And suddenly the old ways of exclusion must bow down to the one who calls everyone our neighbor. Through Jesus, God is inaugurating a whole new world of open doors and generous tables where second-class citizens belong, where outsiders belong, where despised, cast out, refugee, immigrant, uncelebrated, oppressed, all find their place at this party. The food that we didn't used to eat tastes good on our tongues. The people we never used to speak to become our dearest friends. The homes we wouldn't enter become our place of belonging. This is the way of Jesus. And this is what he was doing in that moment, you guys. It was profound what he was doing in that moment speaking to that woman. Yes, at the micro level for her, saving her at this soul deep level. But at the macro level, he is making clear that there is a new way and a new kingdom at hand. And the old barriers to God are no more. And you guys, we see this with Jesus time and time again in the Gospels. This is what we see, a radical Jesus shaking things up, arms wide open, by my blood, all are clean, all are welcome. And you guys, this is the Jesus I found as that broken girl. This is the Jesus I found, arms wide open. You're clean, you're healed, you're welcome. This is the Jesus the world needs. This is the Jesus I want to present to my girls. This is the Jesus we're hungry for, right? This is the Jesus I love. And I feel like sometimes as the church we haven't done a great job of this, right? And there might be people in this room tonight who've been really hurt by the church because they haven't known a Jesus who embodied this. This arms wide open, by my blood, all are welcome. Come, we all have access to this grace and love. And I feel like we need to do a better job of understanding this Jesus, of knowing this Jesus, of bringing this Jesus to the people and world around us. Because Jesus's reputation preceded him because of who he welcomed in, not because of who he kept out, you guys. So, I feel like we'd be remiss to stop here because there is another character in the story, Jairus, remember? Okay, so I want to pick back up where we left off in verse 35. While he was still speaking, so this is just context, he's still speaking to the woman, right? While Jesus was still speaking to the woman, some people came from the synagogue leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child's not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately she got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years old. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. So you guys, I'm just going to caveat. I know that I'm giving this bit of scripture like a disservice, that a whole nother sermon could be preached on this. But I just feel like there's some like important tidbits that I want to pull out. So again, just setting the scene. Jairus has approached Jesus. They're en route to heal his daughter. He's like, okay, he's hopeful, right? Like, we can get there, and this guy who's been healing people, like, we can heal, we can get there and heal this little girl, my daughter. And then Jesus stops, right, to interact with this woman. And can you imagine Jairus in that moment? Like, what the heck, dude? He's like, oh my gosh. And I feel like I really can imagine this moment because Victoria's birth, our oldest, I'm just going to give you a little story here. When we moved to South Africa, I was about 6 months pregnant with Victoria. And she, you guys, was our, like, miracle baby. We had a long journey with infertility. We really struggled to get pregnant. So we're finally pregnant with Victoria. And the timing all lines up that we're finally moving to South Africa, which is another long, beautiful story of dreams fulfilled. So we're like, this is, it's like our promised land, right? Like we're pregnant, we're moving to South Africa, can we move? And within 4 or 5 weeks of moving, we learned that Victoria is not doing great inside of me. So the next couple weeks of the pregnancy were really stressful and scary, and I had a lot of extra monitoring. And then the day that she was born, I had gone in for said extra monitoring, and she was really not well. And I don't know how many of you know this, but I'm a nurse, and I was an obstetric nurse, so I was very aware of the gravity of the situation that we were in. I knew how sick my baby was. So it's very urgent. We're making all the phone calls, calling everyone that needs to be there. I'm calling Joel, like, you got to get here now. They're putting the IV in. They're prepping me for theater. They get me back to theater. We're ready to go, except we don't have a pediatrician, right? And we have a really sick baby that is going to need a skilled physician when she's born. So we're waiting. And it was maybe 5 minutes or so, I don't know, that we were waiting, but I'm telling you, when your child is on their deathbed, and this isn't even a child that we had fully met yet, this is his 12-year-old little girl, any moment feels like an eternity. So for Jairus, in this moment where Jesus is having this insane, beautiful moment with this woman, healing her, saving her to soul deep level, he's over here like, dude, we gotta go. We gotta go. Like, we were en route. We were on mission. He was hopeful. We were gonna do something together, Jesus. And Jesus stops, and he has this moment. And then Jairus learns that his daughter has died. It's too late. There's no point. And I just imagine in that moment him like crumbling to the ground in grief. Right? Like, he's just heard that his daughter has died. But not only grief. Like, I feel like he'd be angry. Like, I feel like he'd be like, Jesus, what the heck? Like, you stop to, like, talk with her when, like, just, like, angry, like, actually angry at him. Like, and Jesus turns to him and says, do not fear, only believe. And then if I imagine the strength and courage that Jairus would have had to muster up in that moment to get up. I mean, I just imagine him weeping, and he's like, okay, now I have to keep on with this guy who just failed me, basically. So, but he does. They carry on. They get to the house. And when they arrive, it's the scene they expected, right? To everyone else but Jesus, this girl is clearly dead. And again, I'm doing the story a disservice, but he's mocked. They laugh at him because he's saying she's just sleeping. And then two simple words. And resurrection life. And this little girl is alive. She's whole. She's well. And you guys, here's what I want to pull from the story tonight. To Jairus, it seemed like Jesus took too long, right? Jesus, you took too long, and I see hopelessness, and I see death. And where we see hopelessness and death, where we see a Jesus who has turned his attention and taken far too long, Jesus sees an opportunity to show up with resurrection life and power, right? And you guys, I just thought of this last night late when I couldn't sleep, but Joel and I get asked often, maybe almost daily, like, why are you guys here? When they find out we're American, I mean, we just speak and they know. But like, why are you guys here? Like, we have Canadian passports to lean into, we have American, like, and those comments come from a place of viewing this country as hopeless, a country without hope, a country where there's just too much death, hopelessness. And I'm telling you, Jesus sees an opportunity for resurrection life. And that is the hope that I have. That is the faith that I have for this country, you guys, for our lives. There are people in this room tonight that, like Jairus, you guys, you need the faith to believe for resurrection. You need the strength and the courage to carry on with Jesus in the places in your life that seem hopeless and dead. The places where it feels like we were doing something, like maybe you even felt like he invited you into this thing, but like you guys were journeying, like Jesus, we were like journeying together, we were doing this thing, and now it feels like you're just gone. It feels like you've turned your attention, and now it's hopeless, and now all I see is death. And you need the courage and the strength tonight to believe Jesus, to carry on with him, and for the faith for resurrection life in those areas. Maybe it's your marriage, maybe it's your job, maybe it's unanswered prayers. I don't know, but wherever it seems like or feels to you that Jesus has taken too long, I want to believe for you tonight to have the strength and the courage to carry on with Jesus, to have faith to believe for resurrection life because he's capable of it. And some of you tonight, I think, feel a lot or more like this woman. Maybe you feel like both, but you feel like this woman, and I feel like the invitation tonight is to come to Jesus and bring your whole truth, right? Come to him with your whole truth. You need to boldly, audaciously, maybe even defiantly reach out to him with all your doubts and questions about him. He can handle it. He can handle it. You don't need to have him figured out. But with all your doubts and questions about him, with all the things you've been told about yourself, you've believed about yourself, your brokenness, your loneliness, whatever it might be, but you need to come to Jesus with your whole truth. Boldly, boldly reach out and touch him and let him meet you. And then my prayer for all of us tonight is that we would know this Jesus, this radical Jesus, who, arms wide open, by my blood, all are clean, all are welcome, that this would be the Jesus that we find, that we re-encounter, and that we present to the world around us. You guys, this is the Jesus that we're aching for. This is the Jesus I love, who saved me, who healed me at a soul deep level, right? And this is the Jesus that is there waiting for us. So I'm gonna close and pray, and then we'll worship, yeah? Yeah, Jesus, would you come in your love, in your grace? Jesus, you are grace clothed in humanity, and you have made so clear to us that your grace and your love is available to us all. And I pray that you would encounter hearts tonight, Jesus, for those of us that are feeling more like this woman. God, for those of us that relate more with Jairus, I pray that you would meet us in these places, God, that you would turn and speak to us as we tell you our whole truth, as we boldly reach out to you, that you would save us at a soul deep level. You would heal us and save us. And the places, Jesus, where it feels like you've left, it feels like you've turned your attention from us, that you would lift our eyes to see with your perspective, that we'd have faith, God, for resurrection life. So Jesus, would you come? Would you meet us? Would you heal hearts, God? Would you save at a soul deep level? In your name we pray. Yeah.